This week on Writers, Inc.
It's a lot different to not have those flashbacks because it's where I do a lot of the character building and it's where I do a lot of the juxtaposition.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I think, you know, when we started last week, I told you about this trip to Greece. I forgot to tell you that we got a puppy while I was in Greece. I don't know if we didn't talk about that on the air, did we?
Not on air. No, that was off air. We were talking about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a standard poodle. He's 9 weeks old now. So just a little baby. And we're going through that potty training stage. So we are down, like literally every rug in the house has been taken out to the dumpster with the exception of the one in my office. And like, I keep like religiously closing my office door to keep him out of here. But like he has hit every rug in the house. Like he's trying, you know, like puppies, like he knows what he's supposed to do. He's trying to get to the door. He's just not, you know, puppies can't always make it.
Pee
pads.
You gotta once you get them outside, it's all like mega praise. Like every, if they just dribble a little, it's like, you know, you treat it like you throw a parade. That you get that dog excited about it.
Just take him out, like try to preemptively. You're just living outside. It's like having a newborn, but in like weird ways. Like you're just up all the time and you just have to like try to like cut off what they're going to need before they need it.
Yeah. Well, you start to pick up on the body language, right? You know, because like we see him, like he'll like disconnect from whatever he was doing. And all of a sudden you start walking around the room, sniffing the floor. And then it's a mad dash to pick him up and get him to a door.
So my question is, how is the robot dog responding to the new dog?
I keep trying to get a picture of this. So the robot dog is totally autonomous. It's like there's no remote control. It does whatever it wants kind of in the house. For some reason, it keeps going to the dog's, like the real dog's food dish and water dish and sits like right in front of it. And like I keep catching it in the kitchen doing that. And like it looks up at you. It's got these like robot eyes and stuff. So it stares at you. But like by the time I get the camera out, it picks up and moves. So it's like I'm trying to get a shot of it just because it's like really funny. The real dog could care less. Like I think it just sees it as another piece of furniture that's for some reason moving. It doesn't quite understand why. Sort of like the robot vacuums. But yeah, they haven't quite tangled yet. I'm thinking about tying like a rope or a ball or something to the back of it so the puppy can chase the robot dog around. Maybe that'll make them friends.
That won't end in tragedy at all.
Probably.
All right.
Electrocuted real dog. All right. What is going on in the news?
Well, first up, more concerns raised over contracts from Must Read magazines. Since buying Analog, Asimov's, and FNSF, new owner Must Read magazines is issuing contracts that demand a full waiver of, quote, moral rights, the author's right to be named and to block damaging edits, plus broad merch rights, terms absent from the old contracts. SFWA confirmed the merch clause is negotiable. Victoria Strauss then posted a deep dive on the unusual moral rights language, warning it could let the publisher alter or reuse a story without the author's approval. Writer Stuart C. Baker exchanged 50-plus emails over 6 weeks before signing, scrapping the merch clause, adding a, quote, no AI training writer and carving back the moral rights waiver while others remain anonymous for fear of blowback. Takeaway for contributors, don't sign the boilerplate. Push to delete or limit the moral rights and merch clauses. Insert AI use language and insist on industry standard edit and attribution protections. Enlist SFWA or a knowledgeable agent if possible. This has to be one of the scummiest damn things I have heard come out of this industry in a while.
Well, we haven't talked about contracts in a while. So I think it's always good to have a reminder, not just to blindly sign your contracts and to try to keep as many rights as you can.
Yeah, boiler, what are those?
Boilerplate.
There it is.
Boilerplate.
Boilerplates are never, you never want to sign those if you can help it.
So yeah, something I've learned from, when I used to work with attorneys and I did a lot of legal writing stuff is every contract is negotiable. It just depends on whether which both parties will capitulate.
Yeah.
So you can always push back on even like your cell phone contract is technically negotiable, but they're never
Yeah.
going to agree to changes.
A lot of these contracts kind of take on a mind of their own because one thing happens with one author and all of a sudden the lawyer's slapping another paragraph on the contract and like it, it may be meaningless to everybody else. And then 2 years later, something else happens and another paragraph gets added. And, at some point, nobody even understands why some of those are in there. But I'm trying to read, like, do we know anything that they've actually done nefarious with because this language is in there?
I don't think so. And I do think though that it's important because a lot of agents sometimes who are writing short stories aren't a lot of agents, a lot of writers aren't agented who are writing to these markets. So I think that's important for them to know. But I think these are newer, so I don't think anything as nefarious has been happening, but I think it's more just a way to be aware of for the writers that those things are now in there in magazine contracts.
It's just that it's so skeevy, like, and so dangerous because it does literally give that magazine the right to insert whatever they want into that story. So it could be something entirely against your own moral or ethical code. It could be something that ends up making you look bad, which could put you in line of some sort of damages. There's so it's too open, man. It's just too wide open for problems.
That's what I'm trying to get at, though. Are they adding text to the story, or is this just, to try and block an ad that might show up in the middle of the story, or like what is the purpose of it?
We don't know yet, I
No.
guess.
So I'm reading back over the bit of it. Like the to block damaging edits is the part that I kind of zeroed in on. Like I had say, I'd submit something to Analog. If they were going to run it, I had some say over whether or not I'd accept certain edits, right? If they edited in such a way that I felt cast me or the story or something in a bad light, I could object. Might get overruled, it might be a take it or leave it scenario that was always possible, but I had the right to object. They're bypassing that altogether with this from the way I'm reading this. Like they're not even going to consult you. They're just going to say, hey, this character is now a different gender and has a different viewpoint or whatever, and then they make that edit. I don't know that that's what they're doing. They're not sh saying whether they've had that happen, but it seems possible to me based on what I'm seeing.
I think
That's
it's
all.
just risky because, like, so as we know, these magazines, aren't always like financially secure. It's not like they're the New York Times. And so if they have the right to just sort of start changing and republishing stories without your consent or, giving you more, would they do that to try to, like, if they needed to get, more readership and or more? What could they do with it? And I guess that's the questionable thing, because for a lot of short stories, you get it published and then it reverts, you get your rights back in a year, and then you're able to, there's a lot of venues that do republished short stories, and so it's like you can kind of, as an author, then get another exposure to that in a different forum, get another, get paid for the story again. But if they retain the rights, then you can't do that.
Yeah.
Ever. Like you're giving them your short story forever, which, I think in places like Ellen Datlow, she does her best of. Like I don't think that you'd be qualified for a lot of those other projects.
Yeah, that's what I think. But could be misinterpreting it. But I think at this point it's like what's the real bit other than some cash and a little bit of exposure? Like there used to be a huge benefit to getting into these magazines. This is why I always in particular, I always targeted like Analog and stuff early in my career because I wanted the exposure because I knew of people who were discovered, quote unquote, through Analog, and authors that I followed, I sometimes just discovered them myself through Analog. But, contracts, things like that would come because, your work did well in this publication. Does that happen anymore? I'm not even sure that that happens anymore. I think more people are discovering new talent on Substack than they are through Analog at this point.
Well, this story came from Substack, so
Yeah.
there you go.
There you go. All right. Next up, TikTok's ban problem could soon end with a new app and a sale. TikTok may soon be sold to a group of non-Chinese investors, including Oracle, to comply with the U.S. law, with a new version of the app set to launch in September, pending Chinese approval. The current app would disappear by March 2026.
Dun,
TikTok.
dun, dun. I don't know. We've heard so many different stories at this point about TikTok. Until something actually happens, I don't know that I even believe half of what I'm reading. I know that Trump just extended the ban things, so they can continue operating. There's something going on.
I'm not sure what banning means anymore. Like, what does it mean to ban it if you're just going to let it continuously run until what? Indefinitely. If it doesn't get sold, I guarantee you they're going to continue to extend it somehow. So what's the point?
Yeah.
I don't understand this story. This story is stupid.
No, the part I don't like though is just like I'm always debating whether I want to spend time investing in TikTok, and I
I know.
haven't because I'm like, well, they just ban it. I don't want to, kind of work on building up that platform. So I don't know. I feel like I'm in TikTok limbo. That irritates me.
I wonder how many others are kind of in that boat.
Yeah.
Like,
I think it's just about everybody. I mean, because who wants to spend the time? And like, you feel it like when you go on the app too, like the engagement is down quite a bit. And I'm guessing that,
Is it?
like viewers are kind of feeling the same way. And meanwhile, every other app out there is all of a sudden looking just like TikTok. Like Threads looks like TikTok, Instagram looks like TikTok. They're all running those short form videos and trying to replicate that platform. So in the end, even if this story is true, it's going to be a brand new app that looks like TikTok. It's not TikTok anymore. So who knows how that's going to go over? And the heart of the whole thing is the algorithm. And from what I've read everywhere else, like China is not going to give up that algorithm. So this is still, it's going to be a new app that looks like TikTok, that's not TikTok, that doesn't even have the same algorithm, and everybody is still essentially starting over from scratch, even if they migrate all the data over. I would personally, I would double down on, one of the other ones, stick with Threads, or Instagram seems to be the leader, I think, at this point, from a book standpoint.
Well, I like Instagram the most, so that makes me happy. I did not almost missed logging on for the podcast because I was scrolling on Instagram. That did happen. I
I
almost
guess I need to look back at
did.
Instagram again. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't have time in my, or desire, frankly, in my life to spend that much time on anything like that anymore. I just don't care anymore.
I don't
I'm a
think
downer
that's
today. I'm
fair.
sorry about that.
Ooh,
I
you are,
know.
you're Debbie
I'm
Downer over here. I
agreeing.
honestly stopped scrolling TikTok because I found myself scrolling TikTok. Like,
Yeah.
I would literally be sitting in, just at a stopplight or whatever, just, and all of a sudden, hey, I'm gonna scroll TikTok. Like, it became an addictive thing. And like, I don't like anything addictive. So the second I caught that, I just decided I'm not using this anymore. And I barely use the platform. Again, that's the algorithm that's doing that. That's why both,
That's
people
right.
don't feel that same thing when they're scrolling Instagram and some of these other things. So that's going to go away.
That's okay. Now you say it that way, I realize that that's what I do with YouTube Shorts. So, but I'm not producing content. I was thinking, I'm always thinking of it from the terms of like, I should be producing content to help direct people back to my books or whatever. But all that stuff is just so overwhelming now. And if I do any of it, I don't have as much time to write the books. So I'm
Yeah.
just going to
Well, yeah,
write books.
that's funny because like even with this podcast, one of the things that I hired a service that clips it up and they create these little short form videos, which you guys have probably seen, and then those get fed out to YouTube and to TikTok and Instagram and the different platforms. Like that's totally automated. Like there's not a human actually even looking at that, and there probably should be, but I know, like I'm not alone in that. We're not alone in that. Everybody else is creating stuff using the same platform because it is happening automatically. It makes me wonder, how much, I mean, these systems are getting flooded with this auto content that's technically not real. It's just based on, the original content. Like the whole thing just feels very, very strange. Like, are people even watching it anymore, or are bots just replying on it and
It's
liking
just,
videos?
it's just robots watching robots. It's just, yeah. All right.
Speaking
Well,
of robots,
that's a story
I'm gonna do
then.
your transition.
All right. Speaking of
Speaking of robots.
robots, AI translation service launched for fiction writers and publishers prompts dismay among translators, also robots. Globescribe.ai promises ultra-cheap AI-generated translations for just $100 a book, creating alarm among human translators who say only people can carry the invisible worlds of culture and voice across languages. Founders say blind tests showed readers, quote, couldn't tell AI from human work, and argue the tool simply opens markets for fiction that would never justify traditional translation costs. The Society of Authors Translators Association, which is a very real thing, calls the pitch, quote, flat out wrong, while Booker Prize winning translators warn AI can't reproduce rhythm, pacing, or culturally loaded words. They fear, quote, good enough machine output will become publishing's new baseline, as if that were not already true.
Well, newsflash, AI has been, they've been using that for translations for a while now. I know a number of translators, and if anything, like they start with AI, they run it through AI to do the initial translation on it. And then a human runs back through and edits it and cleans it up and makes it sound, you know, quote unquote, normal. Yeah. Those translations are getting a lot better, but you know, as a standalone, if there isn't that human intervention, they're not there yet. Yeah, and they probably will be soon, you know, in the next year or two, or maybe, you know, three.
Hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most. Your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Tess Sharp coming on. Tess is the New York Times bestselling author of The Girls I've Been, as well as numerous books for kids and teenagers. Her latest novel is called No Body, No Crime and releases July 15th. Tess Sharp.
Tess Sharp, welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. We'll talk about your new book, No Body, No Crime, in a little bit. It really explores the question of who you're willing to hide a body for.
Definitely.
So we have a lot of writers on our podcast, so we always like to start with how you got started in this mad business we call publishing. How did you get started writing?
Well, I was a really ambitious 10-year-old homeschooler. So I started writing novels as a preteen. My mom is a magazine copy editor. She is retired now, nonfiction, computer science, actually, which is so funny because she's not a computer person at all, but she's a great, great copy editor, great journalist. And so when my 10-year-old self like went to her, you know, in all my homeschool ambitious glory and was like, I want to be a novelist. So my very sweet mother edited me like a real editor at 10 years old. So she made those pages bleed. And she also explained every single edit, like her reasoning behind it, which made me a very good self-editor in the long run, which really helps with my work for hire and ghostwriting career when you're working on really condensed schedules.
Yeah.
Like I have a book right now that I'm going to be writing in 6 weeks, you know, and it needs to be clean. It needs to be done. And so I started querying at 17, like teenager. I was in college. I went to college early, didn't graduate because I was terrible at college. Just absolutely awful. A homeschooling trait sometimes. I'm just better at learning on my own than being lectured at. Just auditory processing issues as well. So it was not a good fit for me. But so I started querying at 17 and I queried 6 books over 7 years. In my case, I was writing queer YA like I write now.
Yeah.
At a time where all the queer YA was about coming out narratives and this discovery. And I love those books myself. It's just that I don't write them and I never have. I grew up in a very queer family. It was very normalized for me. For someone from my generation, that's a little unusual. And so I was surrounded by all the successful relationships that I was surrounded by as a preteen and a teenager were queer ones.
Yeah.
And so I have a completely different experience than most 30 something queer people because of that in the friends that I was surrounded by. And so in a lot of ways, my queer journey was that long wait was about having the queer subgenre catch up me to what I was doing, because we were really focused on the coming out narratives in that little thing. And I sold my first book the year before YA really kind of realized that queer YA could be commercially viable, with, of course, Becky Albertalli's beautiful Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, which I love. That one came out a year after. And so it was interesting to sell before that, and really interesting to watch the trajectory of queer YA in the last 12 years, basically. When I was published, my book was the first book that had a non-fade to black sapphic love scene. And of course, I still am insanely lucky because I started so early at 17, and my first book deal was at 24. It got published when I was 26. I am a ghostwriter. I'm a work for hire writer. I'm a screenwriter. I do a lot of licensed books, which I love doing. I started writing adult, which if you had met me in 2012, I would have like laughed and said that I would never write adult books. I only write YA. But you know, when you're as a writer and you have to keep those checks coming.
Yeah, absolutely. So 26 is your first book. Were you working another job at that time?
So I was a baker and a maid. And so I was really, really lucky. My first book deal was a 6-figure book deal. I was making $8 an hour. and so I worked until I got my first check. And then I quit and I haven't gone back, because it was just that transition from really, really blue collar work. But it also taught me great at task management and deadlines. You know, they're just really much more condensed than, you know, a book deadline. And so I feel like it really prepared me for having a self-led career. And that kind of organization and task management that you really need when you're juggling a bunch of different projects. So yeah, so I have been a full-time writer since 2012. So since that first book deal, and I've been really fortunate. I've done a lot of ghostwriting in between to really make up the money, because I did have I've had really big gaps between my original novels. Like, there's been a 7-year gap between my original YAs, my debut, and then my next YA. And then there was also a 7-year gap between my first adult thriller, Barbed Wire Heart, and this one, No Body, No Crime.
Yeah. Yeah, that is quite a gap. So, yeah. So that's amazing. So I'm curious, back then in 2012, how did you go about finding your agent? How did that happen?
So my first agent sold just my debut. She gave me a wonderful foundation. She was a kidlit only agent, though. She's since retired. And she gave me a wonderful foundation, especially internationally, because she was very strategic in that way. I transitioned away from her after the first book, because I realized with that first book deal that I was going to have to expand a lot more to make an actual living, you know. And so I signed with Jim McCarthy, oh God, I think it's almost 10 years now. So it's 10 years and we've sold over 22 books in that time, I want to say. I've now lost track. We're currently negotiating one and we're not sure if it's going to be a multi-book deal or not. So we'll see. It might be more than that at that point. And I love Jim. Tremendous agent, tremendous human being, tremendous editorial mind. Just a really wonderful agent.
Very nice. And when you found your very first agent, did you just go through like the cold query, emails, letters, yes, that kind of thing? Yeah,
absolutely. All cold querying. The second time around, I only went with client recs.
Right.
So I knew, I mean, I feel like that's really common, you know, and like having a second or third or fourth agent is so common, but we don't talk about it a lot in publishing. But it's like people retire, people leave the business. Sometimes you outgrow somebody, you know, it's just sometimes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, cold querying the first time. And then I went with Client Rex the second time. And I was really much more selective the second time. But I was still really selective also with my first agent, because by then I had been querying for 7 years.
Yep.
So I also had a really strong idea of what I wanted. I wanted someone who did a lot of six-figure deals. I wanted someone with a really robust editorial network, both these. And so I think that I queried for my debut, I queried 18 agents and I had like 5 offers.
Wow.
And then when I was established and I started 6 people with Client Rex, and Jim was my only offer, I would have gone with him no matter what, because we're just incredibly well suited for each other, personality wise, business wise, you know.
Yeah.
And there's also, I would say, a tremendous comfort, at least for me, as someone who writes predominantly queer stuff under Tess Sharp, to have an agent who is also part of the rainbow family, so to speak. And I really, really love that, because there's an investment in it that is really comforting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So let's talk about your new book, Nobody, No Crime.
Yeah.
I'm always in awe when people do multiple timelines and you do some jumping forth and back. How was handling that for you in the writing process?
Well, all of them, all of the books are like that.
Yeah.
It's the way I think. It's actually harder for me to write a linear book. Like a lot of my licensed books and a lot of my work for hire work or my ghostwriting work is linear, and I find it more difficult. I grew up on like pre-code film and 1940s noir, film noir. And a lot of those are puzzle narratives. And a lot of them are nonlinear. And so I was really steeped in that and that kind of storytelling. The 1940s movie with Jean Tierney, Laura, is one of my biggest influences as a writer. And being able to play with the timelines and assemble the puzzle books, because I don't put them together until the last minute, I would say about 2 weeks before the deadline. I start actually putting everything together. And you can watch me do this on my Instagram highlights. I think I recorded the process of both my bestseller, The Girls I've Been, and the sequel. I recorded the process of how to do it. And you can even literally see the moment where I decide how the structure is going to be in the Instagram stories. But for me, in a lot of ways, flashbacks and the nonlinear storytelling is a crutch. Mm-hmm. I just finished a YA that does not, it still has a really funky structure, but it does not have the flashbacks. And I told my longtime YA editor, Lisa Yoskowitz, I was like, I felt like lost without the flashbacks. I felt like I was like gripping for like a lifesaver that I didn't have, you know, like a life vest that I didn't have. And it was unusual, because while it is still a strange structure, it's a lot different to not have those flashbacks, because it's where I do a lot of the character building and it's where I do a lot of the juxtaposition. And in this one, in Nobody, No Crime, the juxtaposition for me is the thing that I was always really interested in, because so much changes in the 6 years between, in the 6 years gap between where my heroines have been parted. You know, in the teen timeline, Chloe is best friends with the Teller twins. In the adult timeline, Mel is best friends with the Teller twins. And it was really interesting to see, A, how much changes, but also as soon as those two women are back together, they revert to their teen selves so hard.
Yeah.
And then they're just dumb babies again, which I love.
And I did like, they had a role reversal where, you know, Chloe was kind of the pampered one, I guess, and
yes,
and then she, when they, as an adult, she was the tough one, and they just switched roles.
Exactly. She's been living off grid for too long.
Was there anything for you with this book that was a challenge or something that you really enjoyed?
This was my first time writing villain point of view. And I don't think that Rick only has like four chapters. He doesn't have a lot of chapters. But for me, that was not particularly a challenge, but really trying to nail his voice because he's so ridiculous. He's so absurd. He's so over the top. I think that in my proposal, when I was describing him, I'm like, this man drinks Coors Light out of a hollowed out plastic anatomy school skull. You know, he wouldn't drink. He wouldn't go as far as drinking it out of a real skull, but he totally like wants the effect of it. And so nailing him and not going too over the top, and maybe I haven't succeeded, who knows. And also doing his voice in the studio for narration was a big challenge. I would say that this was my biggest cast. I think it's my biggest cast so far. A lot of my books are really insular and they're often happen in really short pockets of time. You know, like six characters in the same scene. And because the bag of dicks, there's three of them, by just that nature, there were a lot more people on page at the same time, which was really challenging voice-wise, both as a voice actor and as a writer. And so that was definitely my big challenge, is differentiating them both as a voice actor and a writer and really nailing all of the different voices, because I would also say that this is my biggest multi-point of view cast. Usually I just do split point of view.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always harder handling a bigger cast, but
definitely. Yeah.
Was it a fun challenge?
It was. I have never had so much fun writing a book. This was literally my book that I was just like, I was supposed to write another book. But I was working on a TV pitch at the time for Barbed Wire Heart, my first adult novel. And the book that I was supposed to write was also about drugs. Window to write, you know, a new book proposal. I needed to get a move on it. And so I asked myself, I was like, okay, what can I do that I'm not going to have voice bleed on? And the answer was, what if you take everything that you normally take really seriously, you know, drugs, abuse, NorCal, the ridiculous danger of the modern gold rush country, which is where I grew up. And what if you turn it into this kind of rural campy farce? I think it was going to sell because it was so different. It was much more funny. It's very darkly funny, but poking fun at where I grew up and how absurd rural crime really can be sometimes. It can just be absolutely ridiculous sometimes. And normally I take all of that really seriously and there's high drama, and not that there isn't high drama here. And so that was like kind of my one and done, one in a million chance to actually write something during that window of time where I wasn't going to have voice bleed with my other projects. It's going to be an outlier in my catalog forever just because of that. Because I'm like back to doom and gloom with the next one in seriousness. But it was so much fun to write. It was so silly because I wrote the proposal, and the further I got into the proposal, I was like, oh my God, this is never going to sell. Do I even give it to Jim to send out? Because it was just so silly. And then it ended up selling, you know, and I was like, oh gosh.
Oh, that's
now I'm gonna write the rest of it.
Well, I love that. I'm glad that, you know, you just had a lot of fun with that and with that book. And you mentioned, you know, you're doing a TV pitch and now Netflix is picking up The Girls I've Been, I believe. Is that correct?
I actually just got the rights back to The Girls I've Been. So okay. I had a wonderful experience with Netflix, but the strike threw everybody's schedule off, you know, like it was with so many things, and the scheduling just ended up not working out, sadly. Oh. But I will say that it was just the most beautiful experience in the world though, because I got to adapt the script. I got to work with Jess Scharzer, the incredible screenwriter of A Simple Favor. And she really, really taught me how to adapt. And also the greatest benefit of all, which was just a personal benefit for me, was I got a year of WGA health insurance and I was able to have a life-saving hysterectomy.
Oh my goodness.
And it only cost $1,000 because of the amazing insurance. And so for me, it was life-changing just for that. You know, it literally put an end to almost over 20 years of chronic pain.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
So thank you, Netflix, forever.
Thank you, WGA.
You know? And like, that's the thing is like, that's the thing that is really fascinating about Hollywood, you know, is that you can reap as a writer or a screenwriter, even if nothing ever gets made.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
and you learn how to write a screenplay and adapt. Yeah.
We're playing with the idea of what to do with it because I didn't have the sequel when I sold it the first time. The further I get in Hollywood, adapting my other work, working with producers, developing books for producers, which is something that I have really started doing, you know, is I have like a little shingle where it's like the producers can come to me with an idea. And I'll develop them a book out of it. And then we'll try to transition it to TV or film and publish the book at the same time.
Nice.
This thing I really enjoy doing. I just sold a book that way with some lovely producing partners. And I love doing that because it really stretches you on a craft level to sit down and figure out the differences between the mediums.
Yeah.
I find it really, really fascinating work. But the further that I get into, you know, the trenches of screenwriting, I'm really finding that I feel more suited and some of my stories feel more suited for television than film. I would say No Body, No Crime, though, would be a decent feature. It's going out right now. So we'll see if anyone does anyone bites on it. You know, it is quite a zany romp. So I'm not sure. You never, never say never.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know who might bite.
Yeah, so I'm curious. You've learned about adapting books to screen or writing books for screen. Is there anything between the mediums that you think would be like a good tip for people who are interested in doing the same sort of thing?
So I'm someone who really learns from example. And when I sat down with Jess Scharzer, who just basically... me that she knew. It was just an amazing experience. She had me read a lot of scripts and then watch the films. That was the most beneficial thing.
Was
to really just consume as many scripts as possible. Because like, if you think about it, it's not a medium that is, you know, it's not like with books where you are a child and you start with picture books and then you graduate to chapter books and then novels. And usually us writers, we're all, you know, geeky kids who love to read. So we are absorbing that format. The most beneficial thing was to just seek out as many scripts as possible, seek out scripts for films that I felt were similar to my own work. So a lot of nonlinear stuff. And also to really learn the differences between the scripts, because, you know, if you read a script that is written by like a writer director, it has a lot more information in it about, you know, camera angles and how things are going to be shot versus just a screenplay written by a screenwriter, because obviously then that's just a blueprint for the director. And obviously that's what I would be creating because I'm not ever going to be a director. And so that for me was really, really helpful. But it also, I find reading the writer-director scripts teach you a lot about filmmaking that is useful to know just in general.
Excellent. Well, great. We appreciate your insight on that. So as we're running out of time, I'd just like to wrap up with one question we like to ask everybody. If you could offer one piece of advice to new and aspiring writers, what would it be?
Don't write every day. It's like the common thing to say, but if you think about it, like most jobs you don't do every day. There's always a rest period, and resting is so important. Refilling the creative well is so important.
Yeah.
And so have a designated day off, even if you want to write every single day. like clockwork, take, you know, I take Wednesdays off. I take a midweek break, and my friend Kate Johnston calls it reading Wednesdays. And I kind of co-opted that from Kate. And so I try to read a lot during that day. Or I do promo, like right now, because we're on Wednesday today.
Yeah.
It really, really helps to just alleviate that pressure of constantly writing, even if you're on a crazy deadline, even if you're, you know, hurtling down, you know, trying to get ready to query. Take that day or two off, and also letting stuff marinate after you finish it can be so, so helpful. Even if it's just a few days, even if it's just a few weeks, that space, if you have an issue with the book, and then when you come back to it with fresh eyes, you often find that your subconscious has figured the problem out. I really, really find the more you train your brain to do that, the easier it gets.
Okay, so Tess started at 16, which is fantastic, and queried 7 novels starting then. Have you ever queried novels that were ahead of their time, that the first time you brought them out, they just weren't quite right, and then maybe you brought them back at a later date?
I mean, I queried novels that weren't ready to be queried, if that's what we're going to call ahead of their time.
Well, yeah.
I queried novels that later I self-published. Does that count? They were
maybe.
So it was ahead of their time.
You're not ahead of any of the trends, or
I was doing nothing at 17 except for cheating on homework and getting drunk. So this was not on my radar.
I was doing the second one at that time.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting, because I feel like there are like times in publishing where something is hot, and maybe you were too early for that trend, and they can come back. So
I hear that's how a lot of things is. So like in the Twilight era, maybe it was Twilight. No, I think more in line with this would be like when Dan Brown released Da Vinci Code, or when the Da Vinci Code explosion happened anyway. Like suddenly all these authors like Steve Barry and others who had been, you know, submitting similar themes for years and weren't getting much traction, like suddenly they were being approached by people out of the blue. Hey, you pitched me on this book a couple of years ago. And, you know, so they were getting contracts and stuff.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think that happened with horror too. Like there was a horror flood and all that kind of thing. I think she said also she had a gap between novels in a series. I forget. It was a good number of years. I forget the specifics.
7
now.
I think.
Was it 7? That's what I was thinking. But what's your biggest gap between novels in a series? How long have you gone?
I am currently at 11 years on one.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. I don't feel so bad.
No, but I am thinking about writing the next book, though, in the series now, which is, you know, something I wasn't thinking about a couple of years ago. And I'm thinking I'm probably just going to age up the character. So it's 11 years later and just leave it at that.
Those are fun. I like reading those, actually, where sort of like you can skip ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was kind of the problem I had with the story. This was Forsaken, my first book, and the lead character was this little girl. And like, I knew where I wanted to take the story next, but I couldn't do it until she was like in her 20s. So I'm just waiting for her to get old enough.
Okay. Yeah. I had 8 years between the first Evergreen book and the second one. But in fairness, I when I wrote Evergreen, I wasn't really intending it to be a series at all. So this is more of a sequel than a series, I guess. But yeah, it took that long. And before that, it was like 3 years between one book and another was my max. You don't want to wait that long.
No, so, I was like, yeah. I wonder what the longest gap is. And like,
how long did it take Harper Lee to?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Harper Lee was the big gap.
That was, yeah, like 40, 50 years. That was a long gap.
Is that the world record?
That wasn't really a sequel, though, right? Didn't it turn out to be pages originally from the first book, like almost like discarded type stuff, and they piecemealed it together into creating a new book?
I don't remember the story behind that.
I vaguely remember it being something like that. Like, I don't think it was a purposeful like sequel to the whole thing.
Am I the only one that kind of got a vibe that maybe she had very little to do with that second book, and it was sort of almost a goodbye? Like, do you see what I'm saying? I almost felt, I don't know, man. I don't know the story. I'm not gonna go off in the weeds on with conjecture. But when that came out, I remember getting kind of a vibe that someone else put this together for her as a kind of send off. That's what it felt like to me.
What was the gap between Handmaid's Tale and The Tenants? That must have been a big one too.
Handmaid's Tale came out when the '80s, like the '80s. I want to say like 88. So then, yeah, that's probably a nice 30
That's a good
years.
Gap too. Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, she flashed forward on that one too. So that one wasn't like a direct sequel. That one, kind of interesting that the show sparked that too, just because the show started going on. And so then it was like, how do you sort of like bridge the gap now?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting idea.
How long has it been for George Martin?
Oh boy.
Oh my God.
A long time.
Like 2000. When did Dance of Dragons was the last
Sounds
one?
Sounds right.
Like
I
2005,
guess.
Maybe?
I believe you.
Ish.
Yeah.
2004,
They're going on 20 years.
He's not going to finish it, by the way.
No.
He's
never.
Even said he's not going to finish it.
It's God. Too much pressure now. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I thought that was interesting that Tess was talking about is that she missed flashbacks in one of her books because that felt weird because she uses them for character building. Do you use your flashbacks for character building? Do you do
Do you
that?
use flashbacks?
What do you use them for? Do you use flashbacks? What do you use them for?
I've used them before for that. The book that I'm writing right now with Patterson, we're writing it in first person, and there's some flashback stuff, and we're writing the main stuff in present tense, and the flashbacks in past tense, and that seems to be working well. It's a cool way to throw something out there. You have a little trigger event, and all of a sudden it brings back this quick little memory that catches the reader up. It's a fun way to get a backstory out there.
I do them very fast as a tiny bit of exposition sometimes, which is probably the wrong way to use them. But I mean, very fast, like, a paragraph or so of, this guy just is in the back of a car that just pulled into a parking lot, and a quick flashback of a few sentences of earlier in the day when he was having a conversation or something,
The same thing, or is she talking about, because when they were talking, and even JD, you said, because you're using it in third person, those are like actual like chapters, even if they're short chapters.
Yeah,
right?
More like I guess dual timeline flashbacks too, right?
Okay.
Yeah,
because I think everyone kind of does what you do. Well, maybe not everyone, but I do think that's very like, someone pulls up and then you have like a memory of like or something.
I think it's just like you just have to be intentional with them. I forget I was in some workshop years ago and some agent said flashbacks are death. And that stuck with me. So I always try
Great
to be
title,
very
by the
intentional
way.
With flashbacks.
That is a good title.
Flashbacks are death.
I don't know. I think it kind of depends. Like, I think in thrillers, you get that a lot. It's like you get like the flashbacks from like another person's perspective or like earlier in that day. And so it kind of like builds up to like whatever's happening. I don't know. I like them. I think that they can work. They're definitely done badly sometimes.
Yeah. I especially like them when they're from a villain's perspective. So yes, please give me all of those.
Yeah. And if you don't know that it's the villain's perspective, that's a lot of fun too. Like you're not quite sure who the flashback is from. I like those a lot where that's also part of the mystery is figuring out like, who is this person talking to me from this perspective?
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of fun.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. We're running out of time. So I guess I will just ask JD who is up next week.
Next week, we've got Christina Dotson coming on. She's an award-winning author as well as a licensed clinical social worker. Her latest novel is about two best friends whose hobby of crashing weddings takes a deadly turn. The book is called Love You to Death and releases July 22nd.
Oh, it sounds so fun. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.